If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
I'm sitting here with an old friend. We're not really friends, but we've known each other for a long time. Jeff Lindbergh's a musical director and one of the founders of the Chicago Jazz Orchestra. It is nice to see you.
Great to be here, Rick.
You know, we're not friends because we didn't go drinking together in too many places, but I've been an admirer forever. And when the Tribune used to cover jazz with some regularity, Howard Wright did what I think was just an amazing job of covering what you've done.
Yes, he was a great friend, and he did a lot for us.
Sure he still is if he gets out. Howard never drank. That's another reason. We hung out at clubs together. Take me back, if you would, Jeff, before our special guest arrives, to the founding of it wasn't the Chicago Jazz Orchestra then.
Correct. It started out as the Jazz Members Big Band, and it was founded in the fall of 1978.
Wow.
Michael Blandick was the mayor then.
Oh, my God.
And it was essentially...
Yeah, one of the great jazz fans of City Hall.
It was essentially a group of players who had gone to the University of Illinois in Urbana,
mm-hmm.
and come up here. Either they had been here already or graduated in spring of 78, and we decided to keep the band going.
Where were you from originally?
Flossmoor. I grew up in Flossmoor.
You're an HF guy?
Yep.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah.
Why did the whole notion of forming something instead of just coming up here and trying to get jobs, did you think it would enable you or help you or sort of make a foundation for all of you young players?
Well, the other co-leader was Steve Jensen, mm-hmm. the co-founder, and he passed away in 1997. But and I can't speak for him.
Sure.
But the reason why I wanted to start a band is that I wanted to play in one of the great bands like Count Basie's or Duke Ellington's, and I figured I probably don't have a shot of making that. So I wanted to start a band my own that sounded like those groups, and that, you know,
What was the state of big band music at that time in the late 70s? I would not think it was the sort of hottest. Maybe it was. Maybe I'm totally wrong.
Well, it was, you know, jazz rock fusion was really big then,
mm-hmm.
and it was more difficult to get a string bass player than it was an electric bass player in those years. But it was still, I mean, Chicago was a very vibrant town musically, and there were a lot of places to play, and, you know, it was a good scene. But, and there were some great bands that were still going on, Maynard Ferguson's band and Buddy Rich's band and Woody Herman's band, and the Basie band was doing great. And, you know, so it was possible to get your chops together in a big city scene like Chicago and then get picked up and playing with one of these bands.
So this the formation of the Jazz Orchestra was filled with optimism then, yes?
Well,
modest optimism.
It was love of music, and we started playing. Our first gig was at a place called Gaspar's.
Remember it well.
Corner of Southport and Belmont.
Or Shubas.
It's now Shubas. Yeah. And we started playing on Sunday evenings for The Door, which meant that we paid everybody in the band about $3 a piece at the end of the night.
Yeah. Wow.
And I love transcribing recordings, you know, and I got into doing Basie and Ellington. So we started doing a lot of Basie and Ellington. And we got our first big break when the first official Chicago Jazz Festival was in August of 1979.
Mm.
And we were asked to open the first night of the first annual Chicago Jazz Festival.
Wow. Who was programming the Jazz Festival then?
Well, it was mostly the Jazz Institute, I believe.
Right.
Penny Tyler and Art Hoyle was mm-hmm. on that committee mm-hmm. and, you know, a few other great people that, you know, were trying to promote the music and Chicago musicians.
But so you had a one-day-a-week gig at Gaspar's, and then you hit the Jazz Fest. And I know you're not, most jazz people I know are not good business people, but you're sitting there, you're trying to figure out how do we, and you all would look for work. How many members were in
17.
and you would all look for freelance work or teaching or something else during the whole thing. That first year must have been, I suppose, it was kind of triumphant when you hit that stage in Grant Park.
Well, it was good in that was the summer after the big snowstorm. Remember the 79 January?
That killed Blandick.
That's right. Yeah. Speaking of him. And so it was a rough winter, and a lot of our gigs were canceled, and it was difficult to get people out. And so when we were asked to perform, it was a great opportunity.
Now, how did you take, as a musician, how did you take there are certain administrative duties involved in running an orchestra. I'm not sure Duke Ellington did all the administrative stuff for his band, but there's a lot of hustling.
Right, and it was, done at a very low level. Now, of course, the orchestra, we have our own board of directors and people who take care of all those things.
When did the name change come?
That was in 2000.
Why?
I just thought that the name of the band was too difficult to remember and too difficult to say, and I also wanted to expand our repertoire to include things involving more than just the standard big band instrumentation. The five saxes, four trombones, four trumpets, and rhythm section. I wanted to start doing things with strings and French horns and different woodwinds, which we started doing. In fact, we started at the Harold Washington Library. We started a concert series in 1998 and 99.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we started expanding the size of the band for different projects. And so I thought Chicago Jazz Orchestra sort of encompassed more of what that goal was.
What were you doing, Jeff, to make a living in that era?
Well, in the first 3 years, I taught at Homewood Flossmoor High School part-time.
You're still teaching there, yeah.
Yeah, I conducted the jazz band there. And then I also conducted the Chicago Heights Youth Symphony Orchestra. Hmm. And then I went to Vienna for a year in 82 and 83 to study orchestral conducting.
Wow.
Came back and just
picked up,
freelanced around. And then I started my doctorate in orchestra conducting at Iowa, in Iowa City. I was there for 1 year, and then the position that I took finally was at the College of Worcester in Ohio.
And you're still there.
Right. I'm starting my 40th year this fall.
There are joys all over in various areas. There are joys of playing. There are joys of, I suppose, getting gigs. Do you get a lot of joy out of teaching?
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely.
Why?
Because it's just it's great to work with young people who love music, and it's great to see them develop. Sometimes you have students that haven't had the opportunity to study that intensely, and then when they're given the opportunity, they really grow and
they
blossom
flourish
into something significant. Yeah.
And would you have to, I suppose, in any organization of more than a dozen people come and go, how would you wouldn't recruit them, would you?
Well, you mean for the big band?
Yeah, for the big band.
Well, in those early years, we had some pretty dedicated people, but it wasn't the same. We were just starting out, and sometimes I'd have to beg people to play because we weren't paying them very much.
Because you made $3 on the door. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were basically doing it for the love of the music, too, and the experience of playing with a big band, that sort of thing.
We'll take a break. We are going through the history, the marvelous history, and especially because it is still around the Chicago Jazz Orchestra, which is an easier, catchier name. It is with the co-founder and the musical director, Jeff Lindberg. We're awaiting the arrival of Bobby Broom, who is there's a spectacular CD, a spectacular album that's out. We are joined by Bobby Broom, who has a lot of keys on a big keychain. I can see that. Who also is an unbelievably talented musician. Jeff, talk to me about Bobby before I let Bobby talk.
Well,
hey, Bobby, you can talk anytime. I don't let anybody.
All right. I feel free.
Bobby's one of the most incredible jazz guitarist in the world,
yep.
And he lives right here in Evanston, so it's great. He's a great resource in Chicago.
Bobby, you also teach, do you not?
I do. That's what all those keys are about.
Yeah.
I'm at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb.
You know, I found that, and, you know, I was never the first-string jazz critic for the Tribune. Though I've had an affection for it forever, and I've met a lot of jazz people, like, you know, who many of them teach. They're very few in this environment who can make a full living playing. Is that true or not? It is, isn't it?
Full. Well, you know, I had a full life before I began. Well, you know what? Let me take that back. I've pretty much taught my whole career. I started teaching when I was about 22 years old.
Yeah.
And I was still in my hometown of New York City. And I got a random phone call from none other than Jackie McLean.
Sure.
And he was the director of the, at that time, it was called the African American Music Studies Program at University of Hartford, at Hart School of Music. And he says, come on down, I got some money for you. I want you to do master classes twice a month. And I'm like, what's a master class? I was 22. I knew nothing.
Yeah, right.
You know, so, and I never had any aspiration or even an inkling about teaching. But he started that part of my career.
And teaching, Jeff was just talking about how rewarding teaching is for him. It is for you, too, because I guess they're saying about just you're not discovering young talent, but you're meeting all these potential great players.
Yeah, and, you know, helping to nurture and inform, and then you watch them take off, some of them, and it's pretty exciting, really.
Do people who come to both of you, we'll get back to this amazing CD and jazz orchestra.
That old thing.
Do students, music students, do they come to classes with huge, unrealistic ambitions? You know, because everybody I know, everybody wants to be a journalist, wants to be a star. They want to write a column, and they want to do this, and they want to study English so they can write great novels. Is it the same kind of thing? Because I think there are so many rewards in just the studying of something. It can become a part of your life forever, whether you're ever on a stage or not.
Well, I teach at the College of Worcester, and it's a small liberal arts school, and we do have music majors, but one of the things that's kind of nice about the institution is that we have students who are majoring in music and also students who aren't, and they're all playing together in ensembles.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a very cooperative type of environment. There's not as much competition as you would expect from like a cutthroat conservatory or something like that. So it's the love of the music. You know, it's like I say what Michael Jordan says, you know, the love of the game. And that's why we're all here.
Yeah. So, Bobby, is that true for you and your students also?
Our university is a little different. It's a little, I imagine it's larger. I'm not sure. It has a storied college of what is it? Really, a college of fine arts, but yeah, college, yeah. You know, dance, theater, music, and... So I believe that it attracts students that are looking for a liberal arts education, but it's somewhat of a conservatory kind of feel because it does really have that. So we have a blend of students. Yeah, some really are aspiring to, you know, make a name for themselves in music, and some aren't sure, you know, some, maybe are downplaying their talent or their aspirations just because, you know, that it is a big thing to wrap your head around.
Yeah, of course.
To think you're going to be the next.
What drew the two of you to music at obviously a young age? What drew you two to music?
Well, you know, for me it was the radio. That was my early access to music in general. Nobody in my family played an instrument directly, and not in my immediate family anyway. My grandmother, toward the end of her life, told me that I had a great uncle or great great uncle that played the fiddle, and you know, they were in the Appalachian mountains in the cold country. So I'm sure somebody was on the porch.
And you said you were from New York.
I'm from New York, but my mother's parents were in West Virginia.
Cold country.
Keystone, yeah. And my dad's people were from Florida. So, yeah, I grew up in New York. And so the radio was Top 40 AM, Cousin Brucey, and it was the gamut from jazzy big band things to soul to R&B to rock to what they call classic rock. Now it was just rock and rhythm and blues, doo-wop. They played everything on Top 40, so that's kind of what shaped my music taste.
When did you first pick up a guitar?
Well, I picked one up, and I probably broke all the strings off when my dad brought something home. I didn't even know what it was. It was a tenor guitar with four strings. And so that went in the closet. I really was not interested at all until 12. I woke up one morning with a burning desire, like, to play the guitar. Not that one in the closet because it was broken. A six string. I still can't figure out what it was that made that happen. It wasn't anything on television that I can recall, or nothing on there. It was strong. And so I asked my dad, can you please get me a guitar? I want to learn how to play the guitar.
He must have wound up being very proud of you from such a meager
in
size.
Bobby,
you broke that first guitar. What's the matter with you? Jeff, what about you?
Well, we had a lot of music in our family. My father played clarinet by ear, and he was a big Benny Goodman fan. And he loved the big bands, Count Basie, Duke Ellington. And my aunt, my father's sister, was a fabulous pianist. She could play anything by ear. If she heard a tune, she'd sit down and play it right away. I mean, that kind of talent. So I suppose I got some genetic material.
You start taking piano lessons early, or what did you do? I mean... You broke your piano, like Bobby?
No. I started taking piano in third grade. I started fooling around on piano, I think, when I was like six. I'd sit there and plink out major chords and minor chords and hear the difference. And so my parents thought, let's give him lessons. And that's when
I started. Maybe he can make a living at this. Both of these gentlemen do make a living and make a great living. And they have made an astonishing CD. It's a lot of years in the coming, that's for sure. You're going to listen to it after the news at the bottom of the hour. You're not going to explain how this CD came to be. I just got to ask you, you both must be astonishingly proud of this thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's done quite well.
We got to talk about it. I mean, I didn't even know there were lists. I've long since forgotten radios don't play jazz much. And we're going to play some today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sitting here with Jeff Lindberg, the co-founder and musical director. You say music instead of artistic?
Artistic.
Artistic musical director. And one of the stars, the Chicago Jazz Orchestra's Bobby Broom. You guys, the reason you're in here is sometime, not that long ago, Jeff, you sent me a CD, and I fell head over heels with the CD. I knew a little about Wes Montgomery, but... Now I'm trying to find everything about him because, Bobby, this is an amazing CD. Let me just, how did it come to be? It's a long time in coming.
Right. Well, I think the seeds of the CD began with a live performance that we did at the Harold Washington Library back in 2004.
Wow.
And the point of that performance was to, I transcribed most of the material that we played on that that performance, and we pretty much...
What does that mean for listeners? What does that mean, transcribe?
Well, I'd listen to the recordings and write out the arrangement.
All the parts.
Yeah.
Each instrument. Yeah.
And we used strings and the big band, and it was very successful. Mm-hmm. And we thought about, hey, let's record this. And it took a while to unfold, and we wanted to do, and of course Bobby can explain even further, we wanted to do something that just wasn't a rehashing of what Wes recorded.
Sure.
We wanted to do new arrangements, so most of the arrangements on this album were done for this album.
What was and is Wes Montgomery to you, Bobby?
Oh, well, to me, he is really like the... the father, in a way, of jazz guitar. And some people think that to be Charlie Christian. And Wes really popularized the instrument further than Christian did. Christian did draw a lot of focus during the big band era, being with Benny Goodman, groups, you know, and made the guitar more of a solo instrument more than it had ever been. And Wes just kind of took that baton, and, you know, he was a pop star at the end of his life.
When was the end of his life?
68 he passed, he started recording in 59. Mm. So he didn't have that long
just
a career
about a decade,
as a solo artist, but he left a lot of music. And had different periods in, like all the greats, you know, have during his career. And he really popularized the instrument. He kind of created this crossover jazz, which some people call smooth jazz, whatever. But, you know, like a crossover version of instrumental jazz music.
Yeah.
He was pretty much the founder of that.
A naive question, but I'm a naive person. How does jazz guitar, or so-called jazz guitar, and I don't like labels much anyway, mm-hmm. how does it differ from rock, the conventional? What most people are thinking of, they're thinking of, you know...
Distortion, the very searing,
yes,
long notes, loud, and almost horn-like in a way, exciting, you know, aggressive. Jazz guitar is, I hate to use that word mellow, because then people start to get that idea. It does not have to be. As you can see on the CD, you can hear that it's not always, it's maybe half mellow and half not. It can be exciting and jaunty and quirky and very rhythmic. So the main difference, though, to me is that you're just hearing the guitar and the amplifier for the most part.
Gotcha.
You know, most jazz guitarists, or I won't say most, a lot of jazz guitarists use no effects, and that is really the tradition of the instrument in that genre. Charlie Christian, Wes Montgomery, Kenny Burrell, George mm-hmm. Benson, Pat Martino, on and on and on.
Jeff, when you decide your dream of making this thing 20 years ago, and to do all new arrangements of this to reinvigorate the songs.
Well, I think, and Bobby maybe can speak to this a little bit more, but paying homage to Wes, but also doing the music in a different light. And like when Bobby plays, he doesn't try to sound like Wes Montgomery all the time.
Right, sure.
He does his own solos. He's obviously influenced by him. But
so it's kind of an homage,
yes,
in a sense.
Yeah.
And an updated.
I was pretty adamant about not wanting to do the original. You know, that we kept two, and they're great, and they've been enhanced. You know, we and Jeff enhanced one in particular, that the title song "More, More, or More" was enhanced with woodwinds, right?
Strings.
Strings. Okay, so. But I just felt like we can do something with, that's the kind of creative person I am. I don't like to just rest on someone else's thing.
I thought it would be exciting
for me and everyone, you know, the band and everyone.
It took 20 years. Why?
Well, first of all, this was not an inexpensive project.
Sure.
And so to raise the money to actually do it right, we could have done it a few years ago, but this cost a good deal of money. We needed a large studio, which we found mm-hmm. In the Philharmonic Studios, mm-hmm. and we wanted to be able to use the full orchestra and effects of not only big band, but also adding strings and different woodwind instruments. And so there's a lot of variety on this album, and again, it took three arrangers to do it, which turned out well.
All right. Should we hear some of it now? What do you guys?
It sounds like you want to.
Yeah. I've been playing this thing. I know you can't ruin the grooves on a CD, but I've played it enough to ruin the grooves.
Well, this is available on vinyl too. So
that's right. When does that happen?
It's now out on vinyl.
Yeah. Where do people get this?
They can order it from website, cjomusic.org.
That's cjomusic.org. You can learn more about the organization itself. And we'll talk about the upcoming residency at Jazz Showcase. Dan Long, could we play some of this song, please? This is off the CD. You'll know this song. And if you don't, we'll tell you after it's over. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that that song. That song was, of course, "What the World Needs Now Is Love." That is my guest, the inimitable Bobby Broom on guitar, and Jeff Lindberg on
Chicago Jazz Orchestra.
Well, an impresario, impresario, and everything else, an arranger of that. You arranged that one?
No, Charlie Harrison did that one.
Okay. I'm getting too much into the jazz weeds here. Why do you need other arrangers?
Just to give a variety.
Oh, okay.
Does
each arranger have a specific talent?
Specialty,
and,
yeah.
Is
absolutely.
That right? Wow, yeah. I never knew that.
Well, you want an arranger that has a distinctive sound. You know, like when you hear arrangements by Nelson Riddle, you can kind of, that's Nelson Riddle.
Maybe Frank Sinatra should sing that song, yeah.
Well, so, and we wanted this to have some variety in sound. So, Charlie Harrison, who was born in Chicago, now lives in L.A.,
This CD is a hit, to put it mildly.
It's doing very well on the charts. It was number one the week of May 26th. It's fallen down to two, but we're hoping it'll get right back up there.
Oh, was it two again? Oh, good. I didn't know that. Once it dropped from one, I stopped looking.
No, it's two. And the numbers were close, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, it could come back. But, to make number one is really... And, there are still over 200 jazz stations around the country, North America.
Is that right?
Yeah, they don't all report to the chart, but they do exist. And so about 40 or so do report to this chart. And so it's just really, it's an accomplishment.
Oh, no question. And a deserving one too. You also, Jeff, and I don't know if you played a part in any of these, Bobby, you do a sort of, you camp out during some of the summertime at the Jazz Showcase.
Correct. We play a weekly Monday gig, and our summer series is starting tomorrow at the Jazz Showcase with Paul Marinaro singing.
Who's been on this show, and who's a nice man and a good singer.
So we play every Monday from 5:30 to 7, 190-minute set.
With guest artists?
Yes.
Guest singers?
Well,
only?
No, we have mostly singers, but we have a lot of instrumentalists, too.
What about this fine man here?
With us, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've done quite a few of those, and then some at the Green Mill.
Right.
When you were resident there.
Both of you, it's a rare opportunity to ask you this question. What's the state of jazz, not just in Chicago, but in general? Is healthy?
It remains healthy, really, in spite of everything external. I mean, we've heard jazz is dead since at least 1959, and probably since 1920, when the press was lambasting it, trying to stop their children from dancing.
Well, the press has never been any good about contemporary music.
So,
get a haircut. Yeah, don't play that Elvis.
But it continues to thrive, and now really in the last 20 or more years with the advent of jazz education, it's kind of in that way stronger than ever. I don't know that translates directly or how it translates directly. I'm sure it does in some ways and then in others not. So the concert series, subscription series at performing arts centers and that kind of thing are probably strong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about club dates.
Yeah, I have a feeling. I mean, there are fewer clubs now than there were when I was younger, when Judy Roberts was playing the hotel lobby of the Intercontinental and that kind of thing. The people coming into the orchestra now, how are they different than your first? They're younger, of course.
I think, I don't really notice that much. We have great players in town. They're great young players. And there were good players back then. So, I mean, this as far as a number of really good and talented players, there are as many as there ever were.
Wow, that's great.
In my opinion.
That's
and
good
the
to hear.
Interest at the college level is really high. I know a lot of schools have put money into the jazz programs because they realize that if a trumpet player comes to play jazz, they may also play in the marching band. Mm-hmm. So, that's been a thing that has caused growth at the college level.
Wow.
In jazz.
So what happens? The success of this, More and More, it certainly is wonderful and it's an accomplishment, but does it empower you and make the two of you think, well, maybe we should do another one of these? I know you're not totally driven commercially, but there's got to be something in the reception this thing has gotten, and just in how good it is, that it tells you something.
Well, for it to just be on the recording, that's great. But I think it'd be wonderful if we could generate lots of live performances for this music, and that would be wonderful to have happen in the next year or two.
Yeah, I agree. Most of my recent career has been proving myself. I don't know to who, maybe to no one, but just that. When I entered into this, I had very high hopes and vision. I always have vision for the things that I do. And then I have to let it go because I don't have control over whether the radio is going to like it, whether people are going to like it, but I hold out hope. And, making that number one spot was certainly something that I thought it deserved when we finished it.
So now you, Jeff Lindberg, Mr. Impresario, do you now start looking for venues? Do you start, you don't book them yourself, but you know, the whole notion of doing this live, what's the next step in that process?
Well, this requires a large orchestra, almost 40 players to do live. So we'd have to find larger venues. We'd love to play it at the Jazz Festival. We'd love to play it at Symphony Center. And there are a lot of wonderful concert halls in the area, not only in Chicago, but, you know, in the Midwest and wherever. So, I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility.
That'd be just great. That'd be so, so cool. Can't you just get the kids from your classes and schools? And make them, can't you make it an assignment? You're playing Thursday night at a concert hall in Tallahassee, Florida, or something.
There we go.
What more recording? I mean, do you feel like doing more recording? How many recordings has the Jazz Orchestra done?
Oh gosh,
rough estimate.
5 or 6. And we recorded twice as the Jazz Members Big Band. No, 3 times as the Jazz Members Big Band. And then we've done maybe 4 CDs since then as the Chicago Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah.
So we need to record more. On average, we've recorded every 5 or 6 years, which isn't enough.
Doesn't seem enough to me.
Bobby's recorded a lot more.
I try to make one a year at least.
Bobby, do you have a website?
I do, bobbybroom.com.
That's easy, ladies and gentlemen. Sure bobbybroom.com.
Yeah, no E, B-R-O, yeah. Like you sweep, B-R-O-O-M. But, so over the past 20 years, I don't have 20 albums, but I think I've got 15 or so.
Wow.
That I've...
Well, you've got a new buyer in me once I get near a computer.
Good.
How often do you play?
You know, a lot less than I used to. I used to have two residencies at the same time, or, you know, simultaneously during the week. One was at the Green Mill, and one was at Pete Miller's Steakhouse in Evanston. And those ran for long years. Pete Miller's was 15 years.
Wow.
And the Green Mill was 9 years. So when my students say, you gotta get another weekly gig because we missed Pete Miller's and we wanna hear, and I'm like, no, I'm not doing that again, because if I do that again, I'll be getting close to 80. And I'm not trying to do that.
It's been great to have you guys in here, and it's been great to, not just to hear this CD, but to hear about the health of jazz. I've been a fan. My father was a massive fan, who would tell me what it was like to see Billie Holiday at nightclubs. Ooh. And I'm like 18. He's going, well, Billy, who did this? Billy Holiday played at a place called the Four Deuces on Wabash. And I'm like, no. And they serve liquor there, Dad? Yes. Why wasn't I born 20 years early?
Wow.
And he would, you know, he'd play the music all the time. He played the violin.
Wow.
And so music is a part. When people lose music in their life, I think they have lost a really essential element.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about Taylor Swift or any of these people who fill stadiums. I'm sure they're quite good. But the intimacy of places where jazz happens is, I know the big band, and there's intimacy in concert halls too. But,
yeah.
But that intimacy goes more than skin deep. Hmm. Fellas, I cannot thank you enough. The website for the Chicago Jazz Orchestra is cjomusic.org. For Bobby, it's Bobby with a Y, broom.com. And take a look at the Tribune next Tuesday. I think I'm going to take this interview and massage it and talk about my father in print and get people.
Wonderful.
What's your thing on the 13th?
That's at the Symphony Center. 8 o'clock, Friday the 13th, we're playing. It's a part of a tribute to Oscar Peterson. We're playing on the second half of the program. We're playing Oscar Peterson's Africa Suite. Mm. with Benny Green on piano and Lewis Nash on drums and Christian McBride on bass.
Why don't you throw a guitarist in there? Just joking.
Hey.
Back to when you could go see Oscar Peterson at Cocktail Hour at the London House.
Those were the days.
No kidding. Gentlemen, thanks a million. And continued success with the CD, and keep me posted on it, too.
Thank you, Rick.
Jeff Lindberg, Bobby Broom, Jazz Music.